asked Sergey Brin to create closer-to-the-door pregnancy parking at Google for expectant mothers, then brought the idea with her over to Facebook. I happily pulled into one such spot when I interviewed her for this book while 8 months pregnant. Tech companies generally also provide generous vacation and family leave policies. When Google increased its paid maternity leave from 12 to 18 weeks, Susan Wojcicki told the Wall Street Journal that retention of new moms improved by a full 50%. Facebook offers 4 months of parental leave for both moms and dads, and Mark Zuckerberg has signaled that it's okay to use it by famously taking 2 months of leave for each of his two children. Companies such as Netflix and LinkedIn even offer unlimited vacation time. Silicon Valley's nature is to look for groundbreaking, innovative solutions, and it all looks great on paper. While high-tech pregnancy perks may make these companies look good, there's substantial evidence that trendy perks like egg and sperm freezing aren't solving the problem at hand. Getting pregnant is just the beginning of parenting, after all. What workers want, particularly women, is a culture that is friendly to working parenthood over the decades that the commitment demands. Working long, hard, and smart. In 1997, in a letter to his shareholders, Jeff Bezos succinctly expressed a core belief about what it takes to succeed in tech when he wrote, "You can work long, hard, or smart, but at Amazon.com, you can't choose two out of three." This belief that for companies to be successful, tech employees must work long, hard, and smart every single day is one reason it's so hard for women who become mothers. While dads are getting better about pitching in on childcare, the majority still falls to moms. Added to that, men don't breastfeed or pump and aren't burdened with the medical condition commonly known as pregnancy. In 2017, 20 years after Bezos's long, hard, or smart comment, Blake Robbins, a tech worker turned VC, tweet-stormed, "When I first got into tech, I thought it was cool to work on the weekends or holidays. I quickly realized that's a recipe for disaster. Not hanging out with friends because you're working isn't cool. Burning out isn't cool. Your competition isn't beating you because they're working more hours than you. It's because they're working smarter." Not surprisingly, he encountered resistance. The PayPal Mafia member and venture capitalist Keith Raboy tersely tweeted in response, "Totally false," then elaborated in his next tweet, "Read a bio of Elon, or about Amazon, or about the first 4 years of Facebook, or PayPal." The Twitter tiff resurfaced an essay written by Palantir's director Shyam Sankar in 2015, titled, "The Case Against Work-Life Balance." Sankar argued that the time to invest those long hours at work is when you're young, because the pace of learning slows as we age, and that having a purpose for the sacrifice makes it acceptable. He urges young engineers to be skeptical of jobs advertising both high stimulation and maximum comfort. "Provided there's a purpose, sprinting at an unsustainable rate is an act of tremendous optimism," he wrote. "We've been told over and over to choose life over work in order to achieve balance. I'm urging you, especially at the dawn of your career, to instead choose life over balance and make the work so meaningful that you wouldn't want it to exist as a distinct concept. This is how you ensure that your future remains yours." Sankar makes an eloquent case. I agree that less balance can be worth it for a while if you feel you're doing something truly worthwhile, as I have done while juggling three kids and a full-time job in order to write this book. I disagree that this can work over an extended period of time. As much as overnight success makes a great Silicon Valley story, nothing here actually happens overnight, except for those hackathons. And it takes most companies many years to realize their full potential. What Sankar also doesn't address is that all jobs in Silicon Valley don't have to fall into the same category, because the industry is now mature enough to afford a variety of work options. The 22-year-old recent graduate who wants to create his or her life all around work should put in 60-plus hour weeks and be lauded. Certainly that's what many founders and early employees have done, many to great success. But the idea that this is the only way to go, or that this should be the work style across one's entire career, is ridiculous. Silicon Valley doesn't need one more life hack. What it needs is an entirely new operating system. Family isn't the only thing that gets put on hold in the work-obsessed Silicon culture. Work weeks used to leave hours available that could be devoted not only to children, but to community, church, volunteering, and socializing. In return for taking those hours away, companies try to compensate employees by offering money, stock options, and perks. And they seek to replace the traditional social networks on which our communities were built, for example, by encouraging employees to take all of their meals at work or to socialize at the office. So the employee needs to do the economic calculation. Is what Google will compensate me for that hour more than the value of keeping that hour for myself or my family? That calculation changes as we age, and as kids enter the picture, it becomes a retention issue. In a 2012 interview, Sheryl Sandberg rocked Silicon Valley by revealing that she leaves work at 5:30 p.m. every day. Hard to say which left people more incredulous, that such an important female executive could leave work at such an early hour, or that she would actually admit it. The press trumpeted the story everywhere, and Sandberg says a friend remarked that she couldn't have gotten more publicity than if she had murdered someone with an axe. Sandberg told Bloomberg Businessweek that the entire legal team at Yahoo sent her flowers with a card reading, "Thank you, we're all leaving at 5:30 p.m. now, too." Sandberg has said that she spent years trying to hide her exit time. She'd leave her jacket on her chair so people might think she was still in the office, taking a meeting somewhere. Or she'd schedule afternoon meetings in other buildings so people wouldn't see her walk to her car. She would send a few emails late at night and early in the morning to show she was still at it. Now she is confident enough in her achievements that she can admit to, gasp, leaving work in time for dinner with her kids. She doesn't pretend that she doesn't pick up work again after they're in bed. "Of course I do. That's what gives me the flexibility I need to be home," she told me in a Bloomberg television interview in 2017. She thinks employers need to communicate well with our employees. Not everything is an emergency. "I do send emails late at night. I have a system with people I work with," she explains. "If it's important and I need an answer, I'll red flag it. If I don't red flag it, you can wait." Sandberg's message is that people shouldn't have to choose between being great employees and being great mothers, fathers, husbands, wives, sons, and daughters, and that companies need to help make this vision a reality. Companies have an opportunity and an obligation to step into the gap, she says, and what's important for companies to understand is this isn't a trade-off between the right thing to do and the smart thing to do. This is both. When companies make a deep commitment to their employees, employees make those commitments back. Sandberg is arguing not just for better corporate and public policy around things like family leave, but also for companies and managers to be more attuned to their employees' emotional and personal needs. "When it comes to dinner at Facebook," she told me, "we offer dinner, but no one's required to come. I know our people who take their dinner in a box when they go home." Then she reiterated, "I think companies have an obligation to do what they can." Most companies, unfortunately, don't step up, as Sandberg advises. They wait to get pushed. It took a report from the former U.S. Attorney General, Eric Holder, for Uber to move its dinner offering from 8:15 to 7 p.m. Holder was tasked with critiquing the company's culture after Susan Fowler's accusation of sexual harassment came to light. Holder noted that an earlier dinner would allow a broader group of employees to utilize the benefit, including those who have spouses or families waiting for them at home, and signal an earlier end to the workday. Uber complied. In April 2017, as I was writing this book, Apple opened its new, spare-no-expense, spaceship-like campus, Apple Park, at a cost of $5 billion. A true marvel, it includes four-story sliding glass doors, rotating elevators, and a 100,000-square-foot wellness center, plus a two-story yoga room, not to mention a carbon fiber roof and 9,000 drought-resistant trees. One thing it doesn't have is a childcare facility. One blogger quipped, "Apple's new campus has everything an Apple employee could wish for, unless they have children, in which case, tough." Sure, childcare might be hard to execute, but Silicon Valley has never claimed to be normal or shied away from hard problems. Large firms have basically reinvented commuting by running fleets of tricked-out buses around the Bay Area. Because childcare has proven an effective way to retain female employees, it's curious it hasn't gained more momentum in an industry that prides itself on groundbreaking solutions. But perhaps that's because Silicon Valley doesn't realize just how much this industry is disrupting the families of those who work in it. Parenthood and the pressure to keep up. Catherine Zaleski had just given birth to her first daughter and had just launched her first startup, Power to Fly, which aims to find women tech jobs that offer flexible working arrangements, when she publicly apologized to all the moms she had ever worked with. In a Fortune article, Zaleski admitted that in her many years running digital products at the Huffington Post and the Washington Post, She had silently slandered women with kids by negatively judging their job performance. She rolled her eyes when they couldn't make post-work drinks, repeatedly questioned their commitment, scheduled last-minute meetings at 4:30 p.m., just when parents might be wrapping up so they could go pick up their kids, and stayed at work late simply to prove she was more dedicated to the job. Some mothers would come in early and leave early, doing more work after dinner, but Zaleski wouldn't value their after-hours contributions. She only realized she'd committed this long list of infractions when she had her own child and discovered that work is so rigged against mothers, and not only mothers, but young women who are taught, you have to outman the men. In tech, however, even men who become parents find it hard to keep up. Brett Taylor, founder of Quip, a workplace collaboration software maker, started working at Facebook in 2009 when he was 28 years old and expecting his first child. Taylor had left Google to start his own company, FriendFeed, which consolidated updates from social media sites. When Mark Zuckerberg made an offer to buy the company, it was the opportunity of a lifetime for Taylor, who agreed to the sale and was later promoted to chief technology officer. There was only one problem. Just as he was becoming a father, Taylor recalls, I was losing control of my own schedule and no longer running my own company and working for someone younger than me. Zuckerberg was 25 at the time, who didn't have kids. I was really, really nervous about it. Taylor says the culture was younger at Facebook than at Google, and he found it more difficult to feel as if he belonged to the community. The hardest part for me as a father, which applies infinitely more so to mothers, was the implicit stuff, Taylor says, such as feeling obligated to attend the hackathons that were integral to Facebook's operation. You face this social trade-off where you say, am I the uncool person who says I can't go to this thing that everyone is going to? Or worse, do I tell my boss that I can't do a meeting at bedtime because I have to be home? Or do you suck it up and tell your spouse, putting the kids down is on you tonight? I face that more at Facebook than any other place, Taylor says. If Mark Zuckerberg asked me to do a dinner meeting, it would be really uncomfortable for me to say no, for obvious reasons. Taylor believes the women who worked at Facebook faced an even bigger trade-off. When someone would go on maternity leave, it was like 50-50 whether they would come back, he says. As he struggled to balance work and family, Taylor found both Zuckerberg and Sandberg to be very supportive. Sandberg had had hard pregnancies too and cared a lot about her kids, he says, while Zuckerberg was always empathetic and, true to his curiosity, asked many questions about Taylor's family. When the CEO eventually had his own first child, he not only served as a role model for other fathers by taking 2 months' leave, he also posted photos of himself changing diapers. But the reality is most dads don't work for Facebook or Google and often don't take advantage of the leave they're entitled to. According to one 2014 study of new fathers, the vast majority take only a week or two off, feeling that putting family first may stigmatize them among their colleagues and cause resentment. That leaves women to put in for the parental leave and the risks that come with it. Taking time off from any job has its disadvantages, but perhaps even more so in the tech industry, where the pace of change creates performance pressure for employees. For startups, one missed opportunity can be live or die. For the big companies, it can mean a huge missed market. There's little room for error. No surprise, then, that Google keeps meticulous performance data and systematically ushers out the people who aren't measuring up. That obviously creates issues for parents considering leave. I look at my friends who've taken breaks, and it hasn't served them particularly well, one female tech executive told me. Things in Silicon Valley change 10 times faster than anywhere else, so in some respects it's really hard to re-engage because there's a lot of catching up to do. The pace of technological change has made it very, very hard for people to successfully take a break and come back. So why not push off having kids until later, until you get to a certain level in your career when you can afford childcare, and your company may be more flexible in order to retain you? The problem is you could wait indefinitely, and by then, it might be too late. For entrepreneurs, the work-life calculation is even weightier. Zaleski says she was like 42 weeks pregnant when she was making her final pitch to investors. Raising a round of funding is never easy for women in Silicon Valley, and being hugely pregnant doesn't help. There's usually some VC that asks how you're going to run the business if you have a family with kids, Zaleski says. When men pitch a business, it's all about the business. Nobody asks them how they're going to take care of their kids. Studies show that in all fields, working mothers are paid less and perceived as less competent than working fathers. There's every reason to believe the motherhood penalty can be especially harsh on female entrepreneurs who are expected to devote their whole selves to making the company a success. Women entrepreneurs, especially mothers, are underestimated, Janica Alvarez, CEO of the smart breast pump company Naya Health, tells me. Alvarez says investors frequently ask how she plans to take care of her three sons, while her husband and co-founder never gets that question. When Naya had trouble with fundraising, the couple moved themselves and their kids into a minivan for a month to buy themselves extra runway. If an investor came to me and said, "Well, we're not sure you can sacrifice enough," I'd want to punch him in the face, Alvarez says. Even female investors are racked by these fears. Sarah Tavel, Benchmark's sole female partner, told me she hoped to have a child someday. "I'm so scared of it," she said. "The same thing that female founders face when they think about raising money while pregnant. I'm trying to sell a founder on taking me as a board member. That's scary as a pregnant woman. And then there's taking care of the kid. Of course, it's a fear every woman has who's career-oriented, but this is a job where you feel that loss of time more acutely." There's one kind of employee, of course, whose life is unencumbered by any demand other than work, the unattached young dude. One founder told me the sweet spot for new hires in tech is specifically 25 to 30 years old. After age 30, this founder said, things just get more difficult. They might get married, have kids, slow down, start to leave at 6 o'clock every night. They might even, God forbid, take their kids to the doctor once in a while. The Silicon Valley tropes around who becomes successful and how are alive and well. The winners will be those groups of young, single guys hacking all night, night after night, in a race to achieve their billion-dollar dreams. No families, no wives, no relationships, no real anything except the product and the dream. All-night hackathons and creepy Silicon Valley incubator homes are spaces and places habitable only by a very specific type of person, captured in the hit movie The Social Network and the popular TV series Silicon Valley. Those young men have achieved great things. Witness Facebook, Google, and Apple. But just because those companies were successful doesn't mean the model isn't fundamentally flawed or that success can't be achieved in other ways. As in any industry or institution, tech's habits and norms were created by those who were there first. And those habits are hard to change, especially when the companies are bringing in billions upon billions of dollars. It stands to reason that if more types of people were given a shot, the tech industry might boast even more success stories. Building a new operating system. Silicon Valley has a tendency to copy itself. Google had free food, then everyone had free food. Google did brain teasers, then everyone did brain teasers, says Brett Taylor, former Facebook CTO. You meet these founders who watch The Social Network, which is not supposed to be positive, and then they're copying it. People copy it all, the good and the bad, almost blindly, and it creates all of these cultural issues that become self-perpetuating. When he left Facebook to co-found Quip, Taylor decided to do things his own way. "My co-founder had just had a baby as we were starting the company," Taylor says. "It was their first, and his wife was like, 'You can do a startup, but I need you to have work-life balance.' I said, 'We will leave by 5:30 every day.' And I do that to this day." To encourage others to leave at a reasonable hour, Quip didn't serve dinner. "After the kids go to bed, I'll work a little bit, but I do it at home, and it's like a secret. I'm not sending a message to the team that that's an expectation of them," Taylor says. He believes that Quip's family-friendly schedule helped him recruit employees, especially women. "I think it may contribute to Quip's having not as stark of a trade-off in terms of gender balance as other companies. We're 35% female engineers, and it's not good enough, but it's good." But don't employees need to work around the clock if the business is going to succeed? It's just hard to imagine the return on that is so great as to make a company succeed or fail, Taylor says. In fact, research shows that output starts to decline after workers put in more than 50 hours a week. Some studies go as far as to say that working too long can be counterproductive to both individuals and their companies. The big inflection points at Quip, Taylor notes, had nothing to do with how much sleep was compromised for work. "In general, it's because we made the right decision or the wrong decision about a resources allocation in terms of what are you working on or not working on. I believe that's 100% why companies succeed or fail. It's not how fast you're typing." Taylor doesn't believe normal work hours have to come at a cost to the company. In fact, in 2016, Quip was acquired for $750 million by Salesforce, where Taylor later became president and chief product officer. It might not have been the billion-dollar exit startup founders dream of, but it's still pretty damn good. So maybe the 530 thing works for Sheryl Sandberg, Brett Taylor, and the average tech worker bee. But what if you're a first-time entrepreneur who's trying to make a dent in the universe by taking something from zero to one? We've talked about what startups demand of founders and early employees. When your company is on the line, can you really afford to worry about work-life balance? After working at Twitter and Postmates, Sarah Muskoff gave birth to her first baby, and soon after, while managing the demands of motherhood, founded her first company, a startup named Winnie that aims to make parenting easier. Shortly thereafter, however, her husband was diagnosed with cancer, though at first they had no idea how life-threatening it was. And Muskoff told her co-founder that she needed to go offline, that is, disconnect from the company, indefinitely. "I couldn't take care of my daughter. I couldn't do anything but get his diagnosis to get him a cure. I felt like I would take a gun and shoot people before I would let him not get a definitive diagnosis," Muskoff recalls. Muskoff's team never bothered her once while she was away and finished Winnie's first product without her. As her husband started getting treatment, however, Muskoff found herself with more time as she sat through chemotherapy infusions and waited around in doctor's offices. Slowly, she got back online, and to her surprise, found that the company was running just fine. "One thing I didn't mean to do, but I ended up doing, was setting up the culture in a way that I didn't have to be in the office 24/7, Muskoff observes. "If I was working anywhere else at the time, I would have needed to quit my job." But because Winnie allowed her to work flexibly, she didn't have to. She officially returned to work in time to launch Winnie to the public. Now Muskoff's goal is to build a sustainable company. Does she believe she has to work long, hard, and smart? Yes, but with a twist. In a response to Keith Raboy and others advancing the idea that less balance is better, Muskoff blogged that Winnie employees don't work nights and weekends because they know it will take a long time to solve the problem they're focused on and they don't want to burn out. She also pointed out that many startups fail expressly due to burnout. "We built Winnie so that we never have to stop working, no matter what comes our way, be it a baby, a deadly disease, or just your run-of-the-mill roadblock," Muskoff says. Like Shyam Sankar, Muskoff believes in working with great purpose. She just doesn't think purpose must be combined with 90-hour weeks. "By building technology to help parents, I'm allowing parents to do less busy work and put in more of their hours actually spending quality time with their children," she says. "That's my motivation. For me, there is no greater incentive or reward." Imagine an alternate universe where even a startup focuses on a 10-year time horizon. If more people started companies that operated like Muskoff's, maybe, just maybe, more women would want to work at them. Silicon Valley is inventing the next generation of products and services, she points out, and if women continue to be underrepresented, the consequences will be dire. "We're not building for them. We're not thinking about them in the solutions," Muskoff says. "Tech is the future, and an entire industry is getting left behind because they're not represented." Muskoff discovered her company could survive without her, but it took her husband's life-threatening illness to make her realize it. "Our work is important, but rarely is it the most important thing in our lives. Companies usually survive just fine without your putting in those 20 extra hours when you could be eating dinner with your family, sleeping, or going for a run. By hiring employees with different lives and different work styles, tech companies could engender new perspectives and creativity. And they would give employees the ability to have a longer-term perspective, not just for their own lives, but for whatever product they're rolling out. Tech should really be a great job for women and families," Muskoff says. "You just need a computer. You don't always have to be in the office. There's nothing inherent about it that should be bad for women. The other day I took Thursday and Friday off. I canceled a trip to Disneyland because Eric got sick. I took the morning off with my daughter, then came in and wrote the best code I've ever written." Chapter 8. Escape from Trolltopia. Women's Fight to Save the Internet. Brianna Wu has been tormented by online trolls for 3 years. It started in 2014 when Wu spoke up to defend women in the gaming industry, only to find herself plunged into a roiling controversy called Gamergate that turned her life upside down. The threats of rape and murder hurled at her online became so scary that she and her husband fled their home. To this day, they live in a new location under an alias. But sometimes the trolls still manage to track her down, and online harassment becomes an offline ambush. "They found our address and smashed a window of my house, threw a brick right through it," Wu told me in April 2017 when I reached her by phone at a number she instructed me never to share. At the time we spoke, the window was still shattered. The online attacks, like the one perpetrated on Wu, began and gathered force on sites like 4chan, Twitter, and Reddit, the largely unmonitored town halls of the web. All of these sites allow or encourage anonymity and pseudonymity, as well as a laissez-faire approach to free speech, in keeping with the long-standing libertarian ethos of the internet. All of them have tolerated years of online harassment of women. It should be of little surprise at this point that the sites that harbor the most vicious trolls, 4chan, Twitter, and Reddit included, were all started and led by white men, who aren't usually the targets of the most vicious online harassment. Would these sites be as hostile to women today if they'd been built and run by women, or at least included a meaningful number of women leaders early on? The money in misogyny. Few places on the internet are more troubled by misogynistic trolling than the world of online gaming. Gaming is a billion-dollar business, much bigger than movies and rivaling TV, including an exploding generation of mobile and social games, classic PC console games, and rising categories like esports and virtual reality. Yet the gaming industry is also saddled with a long-standing history of violence toward and degradation of women, allowing gamers to play out dozens of dark fantasies. One of the earliest rape simulation games, Custer's Revenge, was released in 1982 by the game maker Mystique. The goal was to rape a Native American woman tied to a cactus, with points awarded for every thrust. More than three decades later, our most popular games feature similar scenes. In Take-Two Interactive's monster hit Grand Theft Auto, whose fifth iteration was one of the best-selling video games of all time, players can sleep with a prostitute, then murder her. Take-Two CEO Strauss Zelnick has defended the game, saying, "It is art, and I embrace that art, and it's beautiful art, but it is gritty." Like the broader tech industry, gaming has systematically excluded women for decades. In 2016, the International Game Developers Association, IGDA, reported that women make up just 22% of game developers, with men vastly outnumbering them in management and in powerful technical roles such as programming, software engineering, and technical design. Interestingly, the IGDA also found that men were much less likely than women to believe that diversity in the industry, and in the games it produces, was important. Indeed, women have also been poorly represented in the games themselves. As the report dryly puts it, women have long experienced derogatory representations of their gender in video game content, as well as a general invisibility within the wider video game culture. It's not surprising, then, that the most notorious case of online trolling sprang out of the gaming industry, and that women were the targets. Gamergate was sparked in 2014 by the peevish post of an unhappy former boyfriend of one of the gaming industry's few female developers. "This is written almost entirely in shitty metaphors and bitter snark," wrote Aaron Joni, a coder in the industry. "It's a post about an ex." Joni alleged that his former girlfriend, the game developer Zoe Quinn, had slept with other people in the gaming industry while she and Joni were dating. For reasons that are still somewhat inexplicable, the missive unleashed a volcanic explosion of hate, all of it directed at Quinn, who was a feminist critic of mainstream video games. Though Joni never called for any kind of campaign against Quinn, a certain subset of gamers took his 9,000-word she-done-me-wrong post and turned it into a rallying cry from which to defend their sacred, mostly male, gaming territory. They derided Quinn's game development as basic, simplistic girl work and claimed she used sexual favors to get good reviews. Joni's post was put up on 4chan. Not by him, he would later attest in a note on his original post. An online community founded in 2003 by a then-teenager named Christopher Poole. Today, 4chan claims some 20 million monthly visitors, including a large population that seems to delight in wreaking havoc online. They were particularly vicious when attacking Quinn and other women in the gaming industry. With the 4chan members engaged in the fight, accounts sprang up across Twitter and Reddit to attack Quinn and spread the Gamergate hashtag. The trolling expanded to target other female game developers on the premise that there was a conspiracy of women trying to ruin the industry by promoting more gender equality in the games themselves and in the studios where the products are produced. The Gamergaters created and shared lists of industry women to target and torment, including Anita Sarkeesian, a media critic who rose to prominence by calling out sexism in the video game industry. The trolls even created a game called Beat Up Anita Sarkeesian, which enabled users to punch her virtual face. The game's creators wrote, "There's been a disgusting large imbalance of women who get beaten up in games. Let's add a lady. She claims to want equality. Well, here it is." Once riled, many internet trolls have no shame. They often compete with each other to see who can be the most cruel. And as Quinn and Sarkeesian found out, they don't limit their attacks and threats to a single individual. They'll threaten family members, including children. They'll also instantly direct their bile toward anyone who comes to the target's defense. That is where Brianna Wu enters the story. About 2 months after Joni's post, Wu, an established game designer, spoke out against the Gamergate campaign, sarcastically tweeting a meme suggesting that the trolls were saving everyone from an apocalyptic future where women might have slightly more influence in the industry. That's when all hell broke loose. Shortly after responding to the trolls on Twitter, Wu was inundated with violent, disturbing threats on her life. One series of tweets in particular stands out. "Guess what, bitch, I now know where you live. Your mutilated corpse will be on the front page of Jezebel tomorrow. And if you have any kids, they're going to die too." As the threats piled up, Wu and her husband fled their home, crashing on friends' couches and hiding out in extended stay hotels. They didn't have children to worry about, but they did spend an inordinate amount of money boarding their dog while they were on the run. Wu had a choice to make: speak up for what was right, or be silenced. She chose to talk back. "I was angry, I was scared, I was terrified. But within all of that, I was trying to reach inside myself and find that bravery to really change the industry for women," Wu told me. She spent days documenting the dozens of death threats against her so she could provide them to law enforcement officials. At the height of the online vitriol, she hired a full-time staff member to help collect information on her harassers to share with police. But none of that was enough to bring the perpetrators to justice. Wu wasn't alone. Others who spoke out in support of Quinn or even mildly criticized the trolls or the gaming industry were similarly attacked. Kelly Santiago, a female game developer who now works at Google, likened Gamergate to a witch hunt or a public stoning, telling me, "It was really shocking to discover that I live in a time and place in which such animosity toward women existed." Troll Army on the March. Wu would later understand that she had been the victim of the trolling playbook, an extremely effective technique used to silence women that anonymous social media denizens disagree with. "Find the woman and identify something in her past to distort her with," Wu explains. "If she's gay, attack her on that. Larger than a size 12, attack her on that. Transgender, attack her on that. Find the spot where the woman feels the most vulnerable and make her feel unsafe until the cost of speaking out is too great." Use of the troll playbook isn't limited to the fans or members of the gaming industry. Online harassment is now one of the most disturbing problems plaguing the internet at large. Can such widespread cyber-hating be chalked up to the dark side of human nature, which is simply finding a new expression on this medium? Or have the internet's most popular sites exacerbated the problem by building their networks in such a way that allows, even encourages, bad behavior rather than good? And if the latter, has so little care been given to protecting users because most of these networks have been built and run by men? To Brianna Wu, the answer is obvious. "If we had more women in positions of authority at Twitter and in the gaming industry, I don't think our industry would be so complacently terrible." Evan Williams, the CEO of Medium, who's most famous for co-founding Twitter, has been building websites to allow people to express themselves on the internet since the late 1990s. "Trolling used to be seen as a fringe activity," he told me. "Many of us that built these systems are surprised there are that many people out there who are that terrible. It's disheartening about humanity, and I don't think anyone would have predicted whatever psychological feedback is encouraging these people." I asked Del Harvey, the woman in charge of Twitter's Trust and Safety Division, whether it mattered that Twitter had been designed primarily by men. It may have been a factor, Harvey says. There are absolutely aspects of being male that offer you more privilege and shelter. If you're not a member of a marginalized community in any form, you're less likely to think of those things, she said. Not that Twitter was specifically created to transmit hate, she was quick to point out, but it was designed by people who tend to be really optimistic, cheerful people who are thinking about really fun, optimistic things to be done with their product. They aren't thinking, how can I create a product that will allow people to send death threats really easily? Del Harvey isn't her real name, and she won't say much about her own identity, expressly to minimize becoming a target herself. Product managers, especially those who design consumer products, will tell you they try to be empathetic and do as much user research as possible. But at the end of the day, building these products requires making choices based on their own opinions. In tech, these choices are made mostly by men. Early Twitter investor Bijan Sabet believes that the relative cluelessness about the potential of online harassment has a direct connection to the industry's gender imbalance. These dudes aren't getting it, he says, because they're not getting harassed. When I pressed Williams on this, he conceded. We weren't thinking about it enough, he acknowledges. Had we had more women on the team, maybe we would have known better. By the time Dick Costolo was promoted to CEO of Twitter in 2010, Twitter's harassment problem was already out of control. Costolo, who was brought in to make Twitter more attractive to a mainstream audience, saw curbing harassment as one of the main routes to achieving that, but he didn't make much progress. I would bang my head against the wall for days and days, and then I would move on to other things, he says. Twitter had lots of reasons why it wouldn't be a good idea to restrict speech to prevent harassment. I was always on the side of we should prohibit more things, and I always got pushback. The pushback came because attempts to implement specific anti-harassment policies bumped up against the principles the company had been founded upon. Twitter's founders had felt it was important that users be allowed to use pseudonyms. This was partly a way of differentiating Twitter from Facebook, where real names are required. Twitter's network is built on mostly public profiles that anyone can follow, while Facebook is built on connections that require mutual consent. More important, Williams told me the founders wanted Twitter to be a safe communication platform for political and human rights activists around the world. This was so embedded in Twitter's DNA that free speech proponents within the company were able to resist executives' attempts to enact policies that would infringe on that freedom. But while pseudonyms protect free speech, they also liberate users to behave as badly as they like, without consequence. And because tweets are public, Twitter's design can actually amplify harassment. Even if you block someone who's hurling insults at you, others can still see those tweets and pile on, allowing an attack to pick up at breathtaking speed. And Twitter's rules for what it does and does not tolerate, and how it implements those rules, have been consistently inconsistent. Costolo says, if I could go back in time, I would go back to a meeting in 2010 and say, I don't care what you present me. I want this changed tomorrow. I would totally change the way I did it. What gave rise to online hate? Trolling is the modern version of hateful language that has long been directed at prominent or outspoken women. Well-known suffragettes fighting for women's right to vote often received vulgar, threatening letters from anonymous men. Trolling as we know it began in the late 1980s, just as email became a popular business tool. People immediately began to notice that there was something about communicating via computers that seemed to undermine the good manners and social norms that govern most face-to-face encounters. In 1984, a New York Times article chronicled the rise of emotional outbursts in electronic mail. Scientists start documenting and trying to explain the surprising prevalence of rudeness, profanity, exultation, and other emotional outbursts by people when they carry on discussions via computer, the Times declared. Scientists who were interviewed observed that electronic communications convey none of the nonverbal cues of personal conversation, the eye contact, facial expressions, and voice inflections that provide social feedback and may inhibit extreme behavior. It's amazing, Carnegie Mellon professor Sarah Kiesler told the Times. We've seen messages sent by managers, messages that will be seen by thousands of people that use language normally heard in locker rooms. Over 30 years later, vulgar discourse and threats of violence now pervade the most prominent sites on the web, including mainstream social networks. Thanks to the anonymity provided by many social media sites, there are usually zero consequences for the offenders, either reputational or economic. Perhaps more remarkably still, trolling behavior has been, for many, a path toward fame and power. To take one example, we need look no further than Twitter-happy Donald Trump. In the midst of a petty feud with MSNBC hosts Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski, the president tweeted that he once saw low-IQ crazy Mika bleeding badly from a facelift. Like many online trolls, Trump directed one of his most offensive verbal assaults yet at a woman, and other trolls parroted his remarks with glee. To be clear, men do get harassed online, but women experience the more extreme forms, such as rape threats, death threats, and stalking. Studies show that men are far more likely to be called out or belittled because of their sports affiliations, while women are far more likely to be attacked simply because of their gender. Girls are also disproportionately among the victims of cyberbullying. Young women, particularly those aged 18 to 24, are three times as likely to be sexually harassed online. As one feminist researcher put it, rape threats have become a sort of lingua franca, the go-to response for men who disagree with something a woman says. Perhaps that go-to aspect is why law enforcement doesn't take such threats very seriously. But women do. 38% of women who've been harassed online describe their experience as extremely upsetting, as opposed to 17% of men. For many women, especially those in the public eye, the hate being thrown around means the internet at large has become a place where they feel unwanted. Marissa Meyer told me she took a month-long break from Twitter while she was running Yahoo because it was just so negative. In the summer of 2016, the Saturday Night Live star Leslie Jones tweeted, "I feel like I'm in a personal hell," after she was swamped with racist and sexist attacks sparked by her appearance in the all-female Ghostbusters remake. She also took a break from Twitter, but before leaving, she wrote, "Twitter, I understand you got free speech, I get it, but there has to be some guidelines. You can see on the profiles that some of these people are crazy sick. It's not enough to freeze account. They should be reported." The message of these negative, upsetting episodes is this. Women, you're not welcome here. And if you choose to show up anyway, be prepared to live with any harassment that comes your way. I know this from personal experience. As a journalist, I regularly use social media sites such as Twitter and Facebook to promote my stories and interviews. They're invaluable platforms for distribution and constructive feedback. However, I often find myself on the receiving end of messages that are obnoxious, dirty, and sometimes downright frightening. One user, who stalked me on Twitter for several months, suggested taking me to a warehouse for a whipping, eating his high-quality sperm, and tweeted a hardcore pornographic video of me with the words, "submission time." He also mentioned my husband by name and suggested that they have sex with me, together. "Any boy that penises you gets my support," the troll wrote. And when I was pregnant, the user tweeted, "Obeying me is a good thing. Looks like you're pregnant with my little girl in belly." The cherry on top? When the troll responded inappropriately to a tweet in which I had tagged IBM CEO Ginni Rometty after an interview I had conducted with her, Rometty herself was alerted with several cheerful notifications from Twitter. I've developed the requisite thick skin, and I use a common tactic for dealing with trolls: ignoring them. I quickly scroll past the vitriolic direct replies to my Twitter account, and I never, ever use Reddit. Once, an interview I conducted with Apple's co-founder Steve Wozniak ended up on Reddit, and the response was worse than unnerving. For the same reason, many women in tech avoid using Hacker News, the prominent startup incubator Y Combinator's official bulletin board that has since become one of the industry's leading message boards. The trolls are there too. Most important, I don't respond to the haters. This is accepted wisdom among many female users. The worst way to deal with a troll is to poke it. Though sometimes the words disturb me, I do my best not to let them make me feel like any less of a journalist, a person, or a woman. But the internet shouldn't just be for people with thick skin, and being a woman online shouldn't be accompanied by routine threats of sexual assault. I reported my personal troll to Twitter in March 2017. After the company claimed, yet again, to have improved its harassment controls. Just 12 hours after filing my report, however, I received this message from Twitter. "We reviewed your report carefully and found that there was no violation of Twitter's rules regarding abusive behavior. Twitter's rules state that you may not incite or engage in the targeted abuse or harassment of others. If telling me to eat his high-quality sperm and inviting me to a whipping doesn't count as harassment, what does? Sure, I can mute the account or block it, but all of these tweets are still visible to the public, and this troll can easily set up a new account and start attacking me again. It appears that my troll hasn't tweeted from this particular account for some time. When I asked Twitter for more information about why, the company told me it doesn't comment on individual cases. All of the offensive tweets I have referenced still live online. It feels as if Twitter is telling me, just deal with it. Or worse, you're not worth fixing this. Apparently I, and so many other women, aren't worth alienating one extremely offensive user. In a telling example of just how crudely Twitter's rules can be applied, actress Rose McGowan's account was suddenly suspended in October 2017 as she was in the midst of tweeting allegations that Hollywood heavyweight Harvey Weinstein had raped her. In keeping with its policy not to comment on individual accounts, Twitter didn't explain why, then faced an epic backlash. Actress Anna Paquin called for women to boycott Twitter, and countless women rallied their accounts behind the cause. Twitter later broke its own rule and explained that McGowan's account had been temporarily locked because she had tweeted a private phone number. The number was contained in the signature of an email image McGowan had tweeted as proof that the others at the Weinstein Company were aware of his behavior. While Twitter seems often reluctant to act on behalf of users who've been abused, this is one prominent case in which Twitter was remarkably responsive to censoring someone who was trying to out an abuser. These seemingly inexplicable decisions might be explained, in part, by a closer look at how offensive content is handled once it's reported. The social networks, including Twitter, outsource most content moderation to contractors around the world. While there's hope that technology, with the help of artificial intelligence, might be able to enforce rules more consistently in the future, for now, the task is up to humans. The contractors faced with the difficult job of filtering and flagging disturbing content on these networks generally don't last long and must be constantly retrained, yet wield an inordinate amount of power when it comes to deciding what stays up and what comes down. Their decisions, informed or not, greatly impact people's lives, whether they be myself, Brianna Wu, Leslie Jones, or Rose McGowan. McGowan's account was reinstated, and Twitter promised to be more transparent about how it makes such decisions in the future. CEO Jack Dorsey tweeted, "Today we saw voices silencing themselves and voices speaking out because we're still not doing enough." The business case for scrapping the hate. Over the years, many social media executives might have assumed that combating trolls could be bad for the bottom line. To be seen as silencing free speech can be a rallying cry for boycotts and cyber attacks. After all, traffic from trolls is still traffic. Who wants to drive users away? However, we may be at an inflection point. It seems increasingly likely that not combating harassment might be even worse for business. Today, both Reddit and Twitter are fighting to attract not only new users, but advertisers who've become wary of being associated with less than mainstream content. The most famous example, when big-name companies including Mercedes-Benz, Johnson & Johnson, Verizon, and JP Morgan discovered, early in 2017, that some of their YouTube ads were running next to neo-Nazi and jihadist videos, they all suspended or pulled advertising from Google. Most returned, but only after the company made changes, including doing a much better job of flagging offensive content by hiring more people and deploying machine learning tools, a form of artificial intelligence, to deal with the problem. Ad crisis averted, but the market spoke clearly. Hate is bad for business. Google's actions spoke clearly, too. They showed that companies can indeed change when sufficiently motivated. As Twitter has sought to gain broader adoption, it too has tried to change, not always successfully. In 2015, Costolo stepped down as CEO of Twitter. He was replaced by Twitter co-founder Jack Dorsey, under whose leadership additional steps have been taken to reduce harassment. The network rolled out a new filter that would prevent users from seeing offensive or threatening content, and says it works harder to identify accounts that were obviously spawned to harass others. It's added tools to mute and report hateful speech, tweaked search to hide abusive tweets, and says it's cracking down harder on repeat offenders. In 2017, Twitter said it was taking action against 10 times more accounts than it had the year before. Although somehow it seems my troll isn't one of them. Meanwhile, though Twitter and Reddit still have a fairly large user base, they've been left in the dust by the behemoth that is Facebook. While Facebook was inspired, in part, by the sexist Hot or Not rating site, it's gone on to become a social networking site that is, by comparison, friendly to a diverse range of users. In the process, Facebook has attracted over 2 billion users, and along with them, billions of advertising dollars. Don't get me wrong, Facebook isn't perfect. The social network has a long way to go to combat online hate, both on the main site and on Instagram, which it owns. But cyber hate is a far bigger, more visible problem on Reddit and Twitter than it is on Facebook and Instagram. Because my Facebook account is private and I have to accept friends before they can interact with me, I almost never see hurtful comments. Even when I do post publicly, the responses are rarely vile. Perhaps that has something to do with the real names requirement, but it also has to do with the way the site has been architected to balance product and business concerns. Facebook insiders say that Sheryl Sandberg, who joined the team in 2008, was critical in transforming the hugely successful startup into an equally enormous business. Part of that involved developing policies to ensure that Facebook was a safe, hospitable place for both users and advertisers. Sandberg's influence at Facebook goes some way to answering the question of whether major social media sites might have benefited by having more diverse and inclusive leadership. Sheryl is, and I think Mark would agree, probably the most important decision he ever made, former Facebook mobile director Molly Graham tells me. When Sandberg showed up in 2008, the social network, which then had just 66 million users, was having a dark year amid a storm of privacy issues and a nearly non-existent business model. Facebook's success was not an inevitability, Graham says. Not only did Sandberg help compel immediate changes to company culture, she also took strong stands on the side of user privacy and protections. This was about the same time that Mark Zuckerberg was becoming obsessed with Twitter's growing user base and was considering a series of changes that would have taken Facebook down a very different path. In the months after Sandberg came aboard, the fledgling Twitter was dominating live conversation on the web and getting international traction. He was trying to decide why Twitter was so successful, a former Facebook employee tells me. He got obsessed with openness and how much data they had and why are they owning real-time news. He fixated on this idea that people are actually willing to share more openly than we think they are. Zuckerberg proposed several product tweaks designed to push Facebook users to be even more open in the hopes of driving engagement. After Facebook introduced location tagging, for example, users could tag others at the same location, but those tagged users couldn't untag themselves. I could have said that Mark Zuckerberg was in Las Vegas, but he wouldn't have been able to say, no, I'm actually in Palo Alto. Zuckerberg wanted to extend the same rules to photos, such that if someone tagged another user in a photo, again that second user couldn't then untag himself or herself. Several other Facebook executives, including Sandberg and Facebook product head Chris Cox, were against these changes, feeling they were unfriendly not only to users, but to women especially. The obvious example is you're a woman, someone tags you in something offensive or not related to you, and you can't untag yourself, the former Facebook employee tells me. It was a huge fight inside the company, massive tear-down walls. Ultimately, Zuckerberg's photo untagging proposal never came to fruition, and the ban on location untagging was removed. Before, when bad things happened, nobody had anybody to go to when weird decisions were made, the former Facebook employee says. Sheryl made every voice that was diverse stronger because now they had a place to go. To his credit, Zuckerberg, though he might have had a few harebrained ideas, was also willing to listen. More than anyone I've ever met, he has this infinite capacity to learn and change. He has as many flaws as anybody, but I've never met anyone who is so open to change, former Facebook CTO Brett Taylor tells me. The key is Zuckerberg made as much space for Sandberg as she made for him, employees say. Both Zuckerberg and Sandberg cared very much about making sure Facebook was a free but safe community, but they approached difficult decisions on content differently. Zuckerberg was more likely to consider how issues might affect the broader platform, whereas Sandberg encouraged employees to think about the effect on individuals. She came at it from more of an individual person's perspective, the empathetic, how might this person feel? These are human beings in their bedrooms, in their dorm rooms, reacting to something that causes them emotional trauma, a former Facebook executive told me. Sandberg oversaw the operations team as they refined a detailed set of policies that would guide Facebook's stance on certain kinds of content on a massively complex scale. What gets left up and what gets taken down. Everything from Holocaust deniers to the Arab Spring to offensive satire. There were a couple of content issues like rape jokes and violence toward women, any sort of content directed at women. It's obviously a topic she cares a lot about, the former Facebook executive said. And she had a really big impact on helping the company and helping us get to better decisions on that stuff. Sheryl's job was to push on us when she felt we didn't get it right. Facebook still has an uphill battle to fight offensive and disturbing content that's only getting bigger as the site becomes more influential. In 2017, it added 3,000 people to the 4,500 already employed to moderate content worldwide. This, as Facebook was roiled by the launch of its video service, Facebook Live, which soon became home to broadcasts of real-time rapes, beatings, suicides, and incidents of police brutality. But the biggest reckoning came later that year when Facebook revealed that the Russians bought thousands of ads on the social network in an attempt to cause political turmoil amid the U.S. elections. Twitter and Google were quickly roped into the scandal. All three companies were called on to testify before Congress about their policies concerning not just political advertising, but also fake accounts and fake news. Facebook announced that it was hiring an additional 10,000 people to handle safety and security. In an interview with Axios, Sandberg apologized to the American people, but also reasserted Facebook's commitment to free speech and consideration of itself as a tech company, not a media company. Facebook, Twitter, and Google, via YouTube, profit off the content that the public provides. This content includes everything from fake news to postings that might be hateful or abusive. But 2017 might well be seen as the turning point, the moment when these internet juggernauts began taking greater responsibility for the substance of the messages, ads, and news they facilitate. No doubt there are heated internal debates happening within Facebook at this very moment about how to continue to build an online community where people feel both safe and free. The question remains how the company rises to that responsibility. How harassers fight for survival. Culture change can't be guaranteed by simply putting a woman at the top of the org chart. Changing the moral tone and community standards at a social media company can be particularly tricky because users feel ownership over the site, and rightly so, as they are producing the content. Case in point is the story of Ellen Pao's second epic setback in Silicon Valley. In 2014, just months before she would lose her famous sex discrimination case against Kleiner, Pao was appointed interim CEO of Reddit, where she swiftly tried to crack down on harassment, only to resign under pressure from users after just 8 months on the job. Reddit, the so-called front page of the internet, was founded in 2005 by Steve Huffman and Alexis Ohanian, two young male entrepreneurs. They tell me they started the site as a place to have authentic conversation. If the optimism of that statement reminds you of Twitter's free speech philosophy, here's something else the two sites share. User pseudonymity. Reddit quickly became a popular destination to discuss everything from puppies to politics, with 300 plus million monthly users to date, who became known as Redditors. But, like Twitter, Reddit also became a haven for users spewing misogyny, racism, homophobia, and xenophobia, which made it difficult for the network to develop into a legitimate business. Ellen Pao agreed to take on the challenge of leading Reddit in the hope of making it, and the internet, a better place for everyone. At the same time, co-founder Alexis Ohanian, who had left the company in 2010, returned to help, with the title of executive chairman. Pao, who got plenty of up-close and personal online attacks from trolls during her suit against Kleiner, made it her top priority to clean up the site, first committing to remove revenge porn, explicit photos, usually of ex-girlfriends, that are posted without the subject's consent. She also shut down several of Reddit's nastiest sub-forums, including anti-trans and anti-black communities, as well as one called Fat People Hate, in which users mocked the overweight. Redditors staged a full-on revolt, attacking Pao and claiming their right to free speech. While that argument might suggest the users were high-minded, Their attack tactics showed otherwise. Trolls attempted to post private information about Pau and threatened her life. When one of the site's popular employees, responsible for managing Reddit's famous Ask Me Anything series, was fired, over 200,000 people signed a petition calling for Pau to be fired.